If you don't spread the word, we can't spread the truth. Become a member of the Crusade Channel Boosters today at VeritasRadioNetwork.com/boost.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the war in the Persian Gulf. Big doings in the Persian Gulf. You know my favorite part of that war? It's the first war we ever had that was on every channel plus cable. And the war got good ratings too, didn't it? Got good ratings. Well, we like war. We like war. We're a warlike people. We like war because we're good at it. And you know why we're good at it? Because we get a lot of practice. This country's only 200 years old and already we've had 10 major wars. We average a major war every 20 years in this country, so we're good at it. And it's a good thing we are. We're not very good at anything else anymore. Huh? Can't build a decent car. Can't make a TV set or a VCR worth a fuck. Got no steel industry left. Can't educate our young people. Can't get health care to our old people. But we can bomb the shit out of your country, all right. Especially if your country is full of brown people. Oh, we like that, don't we? That's our hobby. That's our new job in the world, bombing brown people. Iraq, Panama, Grenada, Libya, you got some brown people in your country. Tell them to watch the fuck out, or we'll goddamn bomb them. Well, when's the last white people you can remember that we bombed? Can you remember any white people we've ever bombed? The Germans, those are the only ones, and that's only because they were trying to cut in on our action. They wanted to dominate the world. Bullshit, that's our fucking job.
Sin business that you're talking about.
That, we got rid of sin.
Mike Church Show here on the Crusade Channel, part of the Veritas Radio Network. On a Wisdom Wednesday at 844-527-8723. David Simpson will be here in a bit. We'll do Wisdom Wednesday here. Meanwhile, we have the talents and the blessing of visiting with the one and only Joseph Pierce. We'll get to Joseph in just a second here. Let me reset a few things here for you today. If you're not a member here on the Veritas Radio Network and the Crusade Channel, please become a member. This thing cannot get kicked off the ground and get thrown into Warp Factor 1. We're on impulse power right now if you're a Star Trek fan. Mr. Chekhov, give me impulse, full impulse power now. As a matter of fact, we're at one half impulse power. In order to get to Warp Factor 1, I'll let you know when that is accomplished, but let me tell you, we're a little less than one-third of the way. So, memberships, great. Joining the affiliate program, fantastic. Thank you. Becoming friends on the Facebook, great. Following us on the Twitter, fantastic. Subscribing to the YouTube feed, even more fantastic. And, of course, becoming a paying member at VeritasRadioNetwork.com. Folks, just because we don't drive it into your heads 415,000 times a day does not mean that the need for memberships has abated. If anything, it continues to increase because the climate in which we operate becomes more hostile. We need more live programming, not less. So it's an 80-20 effort, though, now. More help with marketing and advertising and promotion. That's what we really need. If you have any ideas, the suggestion box is always open. Send me a personal email. You can use the contact form at mikechurch.com, veritasradionetwork.com, or just write me, kingdude, K-I-N-G-D-U-D-E, at mikechurch.com. So, to the Dude Maker Hotline, say hello to our friend, our dear friend, Joseph Pierce, who is the editor of the St. Austin Review, and is also, I always get this confused, you are a professor of literature at Aquinas College, right?
I am, and director of the Center for Faith and Culture there.
That's right. Emphasis on faith.
Absolutely. And culture.
Yes. I'd like to read something to you that...
the two go hand in hand. One feeds the other.
Well, whenever I am blessed to have you here on the program, and I try to space you out every 4 weeks or so, but I want everyone to get their monthly dose of Pierce.
Oh, it's necessary. Necessary for good health.
It is necessary for good health. Now, and folks, I'm going to reveal to you why. Look, Joseph, I'd just like to read something to you that you shared with your audience today, an imaginative conservative, but you didn't really share it with the audience. So I went and looked it up and did a little translation, and it reads thus. I'll just read a part of it. The pounded spice both taste and scent doth please. In fading smoke the force doth incense show. The perished kernel springeth avith increase. The lop tree doth best and soonest grow. God spice I was, and pounding was my due. In fading's breath my incense savored best. Death was the mean my kernel to renew. By lopping shot I up to heavenly rest. That is the poem, maybe you can tell us a little bit more about it, that apparently was written while he was imprisoned, the poem predicting his martyrdom, of St. Robert Southwell, right?
Yes, indeed. I mean, it was a very exciting moment of discovery for me. I was actually in a restaurant in Rome by myself, having just had a very good Italian meal. The best place to get Italian food, as you know, is in Rome. And was halfway through a good bottle of wine and reading the collected poems of St. Robert Southwell, the great English martyr, Jesuit, who was... killed for his faith, hanged, drawn, and quartered in 1595. And I came across the poem we just read, which is called Decease Release. And it's about, it's actually written in the first person, but it's about Mary, Queen of Scots, who was, of course, killed on the orders of Elizabeth I. She was the Catholic queen, and many believe the true queen of England, and that Elizabeth was a usurper. So Elizabeth had her killed. So Sir Robert Southwell imagines himself, if you like, in her shoes shortly before her martyrdom. But, of course, the words were very prophetic because Sir Robert Southwell would himself be martyred a few short years later for his own adherence to the Catholic faith.
Do you think that maybe the cause of Mary, Queen of Scots, that she was never venerated or beatified or anything, or no attempt was made, that she was in direct lineage to Henry, might have prevented it?
Well, basically, you know, that she had, because Henry's, there were questions about whether Henry's marriage to Anne Boleyn was valid, of course, because it was adulterous, and she was pregnant before the marriage was valid, because Henry's true wife was Catherine of Aragon was still alive. So there was doubts about, you know, if Queen Elizabeth I is illegitimate, obviously she can't be a legitimate monarch. So therefore, the throne fell upon Mary, Queen of Scots, as the next bona fide valid heir to the throne. So that was the argument. But of course, Elizabeth was placed on the throne on the death of King Edward VI, Henry's son, who died very young. And when Queen Elizabeth was put on the throne, many people thought that was illegitimate, and that the true queen was Mary Stuart, Mary Queen of Scots. Mary Queen of Scots was imprisoned and kept in prison until almost definitely on the direct orders of Elizabeth I, although she denied it, was put to death.
Yeah, and if you've ever seen, and I know that you're without the detriment of cable and satellite television at your house, so you probably haven't seen this, but Showtime did a series, I guess about 5 years ago or so, and it was called Elizabeth. And I didn't watch it. I saw two episodes, and it was ghastly, but I guess the ghastliness and the grotesqueness and just the, it was just gross, vile. They depicted some of the martyrdoms. I don't recall that they depicted Southwell or Compion or Clitheroe or any of them. But I did see the execution of Mary. And, you know, she famously went to the block saying the rosary, saying the Ave Maria, or maybe even the Te Deum. And, of course, like many before her, said, look, I'm dying for nothing, like King Louis XVI. I am not guilty. I'm not a heretic. I'm not this and that and the other. And then said the Pater Noster. And, of course, was famously, they tried to execute her by beheading her, but the first stroke didn't actually go all the way through. So just imagine the horror of this. But this actually happened to English-speaking people. This is under the reign of Elizabeth. There was a police state. And if you just happen to be a Catholic, you might as well have been a KGB you may as well have been a Nazi or KGB operative during World War II America. They would hunt you down. There were spies in every county. It's quite an embarrassing, or should be, an embarrassing epoch in English history. And you and I have talked about this before. And, of course, Shakespeare comes along, and he may have been the only one that made an attempt to chronicle this. We're not going to read much about this outside of the few Catholic scholars that may have gone and studied this, because it is an embarrassing epic, isn't it?
Well, it's very embarrassing. And basically, Henry VIII established a state church, a state religion. He attempted to ban, or he did ban, the Catholic Church. The parallels with the world in which we live, where secularism basically impinges upon the rights of religious freedom, are striking, which is, you know, this is why this is not just a question of historical record, but of topical contemporary relevance, because what we see with King Henry's reign, with his establishment of himself as head of the church, he's the state. He says, from now on, the state is head of the church, and all bishops are appointed by me. At least have to get my approval. So this made a state religion, and the consequence for those that refused to kowtow and genuflect before this state religion was terrible. As you said, in the case of those courageous Jesuit priests who came into England knowing that the moment they were captured, knowing first of all there was a very, very powerful spy network throughout England, and there was every possibility or indeed probability they would be arrested sooner or later, that following arrest they would be tortured horrifically and then eventually put to death horrifically. I mean, the courage of these men and women such as St. Margaret Clitheroe that you mentioned really should be an inspiration for all of us of the sort of the strength and depth of faith we need in the face of secularist tyranny.
Well, and the secularist tyranny out today, and I don't know if it's made its way to your university yet, but it's certainly made its way to your state, is that there is no gender. You're not allowed to say that there is. If you do, then you're a bigot. The state's going to make you an enemy. And corporate America has now joined in on all this. We are in the midst of a revolution. As a matter of fact, I have this quote from John Adams, that we are in the midst of a revolution that is so unprecedented and so complete that there's nothing like it in the history of man. Well, there is something like it in the history of man, and it's in the English Revolution that we just talked about. And Adam said, gentlemen, we are in the very midst of a revolution, the most complete, unexpected, and remarkable of any in the history of the world. No, right now in 2016, we're in the midst of a revolution, the most remarkable and unexpected of any in the history of the world. We have men that are actually succeeding in getting away with denying, publicly denying and enforcing compliance with and public acceptance of actual gender. Whether or not a male or a female can actually be created by Almighty God himself, Joseph, don't you think that this is revolutionary times in which we live?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I would say, not by way of dampening any of what you've just said, what we're living in is horrific, what we're seeing is thought crime, but it was all prophesied, of course, by George Orwell. It was all practiced by the Gestapo and the KGB. It was practiced by Elizabeth Spy Network back in the 1500s. And I think the other important thing we need to realize to put everything into context here is that history is a great liberator, because we could play a game. It's a game I'd like to play, and I might even write a book on the topic at some point. You know the game. Pin the Tail on the Donkey, where you put a blindfold on. Well, I'd like to play a game, Pin the Fold on the Decade. Pin the Tail on the Decade. And you put a blindfold on, and you just pick any decade in the last 2,000 years, and you look at what a mess the world is. Basically, the Catholic Church is and always has been the voice of sanity and sanctity in a mad world. The world is always mad, the Church is always sane, and that's why we choose the Church over the world.
So is that what makes me think that the world is mad, because I'm more Catholic now than I've ever been?
Well, it does at least show you're moving in the right direction, Mike.
Joseph Pierce is on the Dude Maker Hotline with us. He is the editor of the St. Austin Review and an instructor of faith, culture, and literature at Aquinas College. And are you what is considered then? Because you live in the United States now, are you an American citizen? Are you an expat from the UK?
I am an expat from the UK, but I did actually become a U.S. citizen probably about 7 or 8 years ago now.
Well, we're going to give you the chance right now here on Double Jeopardy to take that back.
Listen, you know, one of the reasons I became a U.S. citizen, Mike, is because I didn't want Barack Obama or whoever his heirs are to be able to throw me out of the country and separate me from my wife and children. I'm here whether they like it or not now.
Your latest writings, not so much on this subject, but although I think that they actually are on this subject, are on, if they stranded you on an island, if you were marooned on an island or shipwrecked, the 10 books that you wish to have. Of course, you listed 10 books, 10 poems, 10 novels. The 10 turned out to be more like 40. But what I found fanciful about your description of the 10 books was that if they came to rescue me and I wasn't finished reading the books, I'd probably tell them to go pound sand. Go get somebody else that needs to be rescued. I'm pretty comfy here on the island. I'll see you guys in 2 years. Bye-bye.
Yeah, I mean, the way I paint the desert island in that particular article is almost like the Garden of Eden. I mean, you know, leave me alone, leave me at peace, you know, get rid of the world, and just leave me with these great books of civilization, the great poems, and just leave me to, if you like, wallow in the majesty of human civilization, Christian civilization, and basically as regards the world, let me get off, basically. So yeah, I mean, obviously your listeners might know, I've been on before about my past. I've been to prison twice, and one thing about being in solitary confinement in prison, which I was for a period of time, it taught me actually that I'm very comfortable with solitude, especially as long as I have a good book to read or I have materials with which to write.
What did you read when you were in prison?
I read St. Thomas Aquinas for the first time. I read John Henry Newman's Apologia Pro Vita Sua. I read The Lord of the Rings for the first time during my second prison sentence. So got a lot of reading done. I mean, The Lord of the Rings, for instance, was a book I'd meant to read for years, and I looked at the size of it and how thick it was and thought I was too busy. Well, then you find yourself in a 12-month prison sentence in solitary confinement, and you think, hey, this is the perfect time to pick that book up. And so I read The Lord of the Rings in prison, and that was a life-changing experience.
One of the things that you mentioned in your article about the 10 things that you would like to be stuck reading, one of them was the, I believe it's the C.S. Lewis translation of Beowulf.
Actually, it's the Tolkien translation.
Now, why the Tolkien translation?
Well, I mean, Tolkien was is probably the premier expert on the poem Beowulf. Certainly was during his lifetime. He was a scholar in Old English. So Tolkien's much more than just the author of The Lord of the Rings, although that, of course, would be enough to get his ticket in itself. But he was a scholar of Anglo-Saxon at Oxford University, and he wrote the seminal essay on Beowulf called The Monster and the Critics, and he translated the poem. So for me, he has a feel for the language, both the Old English language, the Anglo-Saxon, but also a feel, of course, for modern English, which he wrote so beautifully in his other works. So for me, Tolkien's translation of Beowulf is about as good as it gets. Not that there aren't others. I mean, Seamus Heaney, the Irish poet, also did a wonderful poetic translation of Beowulf a few years ago.
844-527-8723 is our telephone number. Joseph Pierce is on the Dudemaker Hotline with us here. His latest work is called Top 10 Books from My Desert Island. Previous to that, you had written, and you might know that you can send your essays to me before you send them to Winston and let me proofread them.
Okay, Mike.
No, I'm kidding.
Proofread them. There's no sense to them. Why is there some error?
No, I'm gonna actually steal them and publish them myself.
You know what T.S. Eliot said, don't you? T.S. Eliot said that bad writers borrow, but good writers steal.
Well, okay, I'll fancy myself a bad writer, but you wrote about the tragedy that was, and I was fascinated by this because I think we're in the midst of a cultural revolution, and like you said, you could say pin the tail on the decade. There are things that would be that you could point out in any decade, you're right, that are messed up. Right now, though, the things that are messed up, I believe, are going to lead to, again, and we know this from the Gospels. As a matter of fact, my best friend David Simpson is here. You named did you name Stephen after St. Stephen or after St. Stephen of Hungary?
The proto-martyr, Stephen the proto-martyr.
Okay. Say hello to Joseph Pierce.
Hello, Dr. Is it Dr. Pierce, right?
No, plain Mr. Pierce, but Joseph would do nicely.
Well, I, you know, was driving in listening to you, and I have to confess I have career envy. When I heard you were sitting in a restaurant in Rome reading books and drinking wine, I said, why didn't I do that?
It's a hard life I live. I appreciate that.
Wait a minute, David, if you're really lucky if he's at home today, we might hear the rooster crow in the background.
Yeah, I've actually closed the window so you don't. But if you want to hear the rooster crow, I'll open the window for you.
What are the things that Joseph... let me finish the point about the proto-martyr. So, David and Joseph, so the first act of martyrdom is, and I talked about this on yesterday's show, is St. Stephen goes to the square and is white martyred first. They yell at him, they threaten him, oh, we're going to take this away, we're going to banish you, we're going to kick you outside of the city, et cetera, et cetera. And then he goes and prays upon it and goes like, no, I can't, I'm going back. The gospel, I have to, the Lord told me I have to go tell them, so I'm going to go tell them again. So he goes back for the second round, and of course, the rest, as they say, is history. So he goes through the two martyrdoms. Right now, we are perilously close, I think, here in America, the United States, to witnessing, if we haven't already seen, some acts of white martyrdom. And they're going to increase because there are going to be people that are going to refuse. They're just not going to conform their minds to this unreality that men aren't men and women aren't women. And there's going to be consequences for this. And when we proceed to the red martyrdom, no one knows how that's going to turn out, but I would hope that our countrymen would have the good sense to say, we're not just going to let you come in here and start executing people or start telling us that we have to execute them. Maybe we should part company. But I leave it at that, Joseph, because you wrote about 2 days ago about the tragedy that is the southern United States, and that because it could not and would not at the time divorce itself from... And it was already in the twilight, in the sunset of its evil reign of chattel slavery that we had here in the States. And there's nothing you could say or do that can undo that. It cannot be undone. But the fact of the matter is that because it did begin, or was partially responsible for the War of Northern Aggression, as I call it. The fate then of Republican government here on these shores basically settled. And Joseph, you probably know this. You probably even read the writings to this day of the Acton Society, Lord Acton famously wrote a letter to Robert E. Lee and said, if you guys lose republicanism in the English-speaking world, this is the knell. It's over. Your comment.
Yeah, well, that's the whole point. I mean, the purpose of my article was called The Tragic South. In the sense that I see the South in some ways as being the epitome and embodiment of the tragic hero, such as Achilles in Homer's Iliad, who's this strong, noble character who basically his Achilles heel is not, of course, physically it's his heel beyond the story, but his Achilles heel ultimately is his pride. It's his pride and arrogance that brings him down. So that, in other words, he had a fatal flaw, and it's the fatal flaw that ruins him. And what I say about the South is that the South was noble, but its tragic flaw was slavery. But there were two issues in the war between the states. One was the issue of slavery, and of course slavery is an abomination, and no Christian can support slavery. But the other issue was states' rights. In other words, the right of local government to have its own local power without an over-encroaching, overreaching, overarching central government getting more and more powerful. And these were the two issues. And the tragedy is that, yes, the war to abolish slavery was won, but what it brought into being was this hideously large and growing large all the time centralized state that the United States has become, which bears no similarity whatsoever with the vision for the United States that the Founding Fathers had. So that's the tragedy, is that one of the two things the war were being fought on, yeah, one was a victory, but the other was a defeat. And the tragedy is that slavery was on its way out anyway. Every other country except Brazil had abolished slavery already. Slavery was in its twilight zone. It was going. 750,000 Americans had to die to make it finish sooner, and I'm not saying that was necessarily a bad thing. But the consequence of that is putting in place this juggernaut, this federal government, which is uncontrollable and out of control, which is imposing its will on the American people in a manner which is very undemocratic.
Well, not only is it it'd be okay if it was imposing a goodwill, but it's not imposing a goodwill. It's imposing a diabolical will.
Well, you know, you mentioned Lord Acton. I mean, I would remind us of Lord Acton's words that power tends to corrupt, and absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely. The more powerful a body becomes, the more likely it is to become corrupt. So putting our trust in a bigger and bigger government is really ensuring we get a more corrupt government.
So I'm wondering, David is descended from Highlanders. I'm not sure if you're descended from Highlanders, but we may have to get acquainted with Highlander living again.
We may have to, but you talk about the North and the South, but of course we have our own North and South, and you mention Highlanders. Well, they're Scots. We try not to mention those people north of the border, Mike. You can understand that.
Joseph Pierce is on the Dude Maker Hotline. This is appearance number 3 here, I believe, on the Crusade Channel, and David Simpson is here for Wisdom Wednesday. So, David, Joseph's top Chesterton books that he would be marooned on an island with: Orthodoxy, The Everlasting Man, St. Francis of Assisi, St. Thomas Aquinas, Chesterton's autobiography, which I have not read any part of, The Defense of Sanity, and the last of which is recently published, reflected the best of Chesterton's essays, and that is Have You Anything to Declare? So that's a greatest hits. I have read some or part of all of those, including his thoughts on St. Francis of Assisi, and on St. Thomas Aquinas. Joseph, David and I missed meeting you when you were here in Ponchatoula back in April. As a matter of fact, you met David's brother. He has a picture of you. So
my brother was the giant, the 6'4", 300-pounder in the kilt, so you probably remember him.
Oh, well, yeah. Funny enough, there were several people in kilts at that conference. Chesterton that attracts those sorts of people. Needless to say, you'll never see an Englishman in a kilt.
Well, David is the second largest. So he goes, you, Robert Simpson, and then David Simpson for vying for first place in the Chesterton fan club. But what David and I have talked about this many times. I'd like to get your take on this. How is it that Chesterton could write this magnificent biography of Aquinas and confess that he didn't read all of Aquinas?
Well, because he's a genius, it's as simple as that. Basically, yeah, the story is, as you may know, that he asked his secretary, Dorothy Collins, to go to the library and get every book that she could get on Aquinas. And she came back with this huge pile of books, 20 or so books on Aquinas, put them on his desk. Chesterton spent about 20 minutes looking through them, put them on the side, and never looked at them again, and then dictated his book on Aquinas. That's the legend. And Etienne Gilson, one of the great Thomistic scholars of the 20th century, said that Chesterton's book on Aquinas was the sort of book he'd been trying to write the whole of his life. In other words, that Chesterton did a better job than the experts. It's astonishing. It's a great testimony to Chesterton's genius that he got the gist of what Aquinas was doing and saying, and could wax eloquent on it for several hundred pages in a manner that impressed the greatest Thomists of his time.
Now, I have here I took a trip to Virginia to go. I was actually in Philadelphia, then Virginia to see my beloved brother and sister-in-law. And a priest up in Michigan gave me a spare copy of the book that he had, Joseph, called The Arts of the Beautiful by Etienne Gilson.
Uh-huh.
And I started reading. I think I got to the third chapter. I left it there because my sister-in-law says, do you want me to mail your book back? I'm like, yeah. Of course. Before you go, you said that Gilson was one of the greatest Thomists of the 20th century. What's the difference between, because the audience may not know this because they don't listen to Wisdom Wednesday all the time. They don't hang around for Philosophia Perennis on Wednesday evenings with David and I. When someone is a great Thomist, I would contend, and I'm sure David would agree, that just makes them a great realist. And they have just a great ability to be able to look at, I'd say you are a great Thomist, Mr. Pierce, because you have an ability to be able to look at this mad world that we live in and deal with the reality of and then write about it. Is that what makes a good Thomist, a great Thomist?
Well, absolutely. And you know, that even in the technical philosophical term, that Thomism is a realist philosophy. In other words, it believes that transcendentals such as beauty and love and reason are not merely things that we invent as human beings and stick a label on, but something that exists in spite of us. And whether we existed or not, whether any human beings ever existed, then things such as reason and love and beauty would exist anyway, because they ultimately come from the source of all goodness, truth, and beauty, which is God Himself. So, you know, in other words, that as opposed to the nominalism, which leads to relativism, and that's what we're living under now, which basically thinks that all of these things are merely human constructs. In other words, they're not real. So, yes, I would say that Thomists are realists in the absolute sense of the philosophical understanding of the world. And then, of course, once you have that absolute sense of realism, it allows you to actually see reality in all the other manifestations much more clearly.
Well, you have your chance. You missed seeing him in Ponchatoula. I know you got to have a question for Joseph.
I was just going to ask, I heard your list of books there, and I was wondering, because one of my favorite books of all time, and so it definitely would have made my top Chesterton book, was The Man Who Was Thursday. Why didn't that get on the list?
Ah, you obviously didn't read the article closely enough, because there's a separate section on that of what ten novels I would take.
Novels,
and The Man
right.
Who Was Thursday is there.
Oh, thank you.
I agree with you. See, look, great minds think alike.
Now, did we ever settle? Did they ever make a movie out of The Man Who Was Thursday?
No, they haven't. They should. It would make an absolutely marvelous movie. There's a theater company in Nashville, the Blackbird Theater, that's exploring ways of bringing it to the stage, which would be intriguing.
Now, I began this day, I was like Schlep Rock from the Flintstones cartoon series, had a little black cloud over my head. I was wowsy, wowsy, whoa. And then I get to spend 40 minutes talking to Joseph Pierce, and David Simpson comes in here for Wisdom Wednesday, and now my spirits are renewed and invigorated, and I am ready to take on this heretical world.
That's great, Mike. I'll send my bill, okay?
Joseph Pierce, everybody. All right, hey, Joseph, as always, thank you for being so generous with your time. I am, if you have a fan club, I am probably the president.
That sounds great. Couldn't think of a better president. Thanks for having me, Mike, as always.
All right, thanks, Joseph. Appreciate you.
God bless.
God bless. Bye-bye. David, let's take our break, and then we'll start Wisdom Wednesday in earnest. You got to talk to Joseph Pierce.
Oh, that's wonderful. He's a great guy.
He is a great guy. We'll be right back here. It's the Mike Church Show on the Crusade Channel, part of the Veritas Radio Network, radio the way it should be.